impatiently. "Don't return. We should be late at the hall." Ignoring the advice, I ran back to the house. "Usually, the Bengali examination is easily passed by our Bengali boys," Ramesh said, "but I have just had a hunch that this year the professors have planned to massacre the students by asking questions about the required reading books." He then outlined two stories from the life of Vidyasagar, the renowned Bengali philanthropist of the 19th century. I thanked Ramesh and quickly bicycled to the hall. There, I found that the examination sheet in Bengali contained two parts. The first instruction was, "Give two instances of the charities of Vidyasagar." As I transferred to the paper the lore that I had so recently acquired, I whispered a few words of thanksgiving that I had heeded Ramesh's last-minute summons. Had I been ignorant of Vidyasagar's benefactions, which now included one to me, I could not have passed the Bengali examination. The second instruction on the sheet read, "Write an essay in Bengali on the life of the man who has most inspired you." Gentle reader, I need not inform you what man I chose for my theme. As I covered page after page with praise of my guru, I smiled to realize that my muttered prediction was coming true. "I will fill up the sheets with your teachings." I had not felt inclined to question Ramesh about my course in philosophy. Trusting my long training under Sri Yukteswar, I safely disregarded the textbook explanations. The highest mark given to any of my papers was the one in philosophy. My score in all other subjects was just barely within the passing mark. It is a pleasure to record that my unselfish friend Ramesh received his own degree cum laude. Father was wreathed in smiles at my graduation. "I hardly thought you would pass, Mukunda," he confessed. "You spend so much time with your guru." Master had indeed correctly detected the unspoken criticism of my father. For years I had been uncertain that I would ever see the day when an A.B. could follow my name. I seldom used the title without reflecting that it was a divine gift, conferred on me for reasons somewhat obscure. Occasionally, I hear college men remark that very little of their crammed knowledge remain with them after graduation. That admission consoles me a bit for my undoubted academic deficiencies. On the day in June 1915 that I received my degree from Calcutta University, I knelt at my guru's feet and thanked him for all the blessings flowing from his life into mine. "Get up, Mukunda," he said indulgently. "The Lord simply found it more convenient to make you a graduate than to rearrange the sun and moon." Chapter 24. I become a monk of the Swami Order. "Master, my father has been anxious for me to accept an executive position with the Bengal-Nagpur Railway, but I have definitely refused it," I added hopefully. "Sir, will you not make me a monk of the Swami Order?" I looked pleadingly at my guru. During preceding years, in order to test the depth of my determination, he had refused the same request. Today, however, he smiled graciously. "Very well, tomorrow I will initiate you into Swamihood." He went on quietly, "I am happy that you have persisted in your desire to be a monk. Lahiri Mahashai often said, if you don't invite God to be your summer guest, he won't come in the winter of your life. Dear Master, I could never relinquish my wish to belong to the Swami Order like your revered self." I smiled at him with measureless affection. "He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things of the world, how he may please his wife." I had analyzed the lives of many of my friends who, after undergoing certain spiritual discipline, had then married. Launched on the sea of worldly responsibilities, they had forgotten their resolutions to meditate deeply. To allot the Lord a secondary place in life was to me inconceivable. He is the sole owner of the cosmos, silently showering man with gifts from life to life. There is but one gift man may offer in return, his love, which he is empowered to withhold or bestow. In taking infinite pains to shroud with mystery his presence in the atoms of creation, the Creator could have had but one motive, one sensitive desire, that man seek him only through free will. With what velvet glove of every humility has he not covered the iron hand of omnipotence? The following day was one of the most memorable in my life. It was a sunny Thursday, I remember, in July 1915, a few weeks after my graduation from college. On the inner balcony of his Sedum Poor Hermitage, Master dipped a new piece of white silk into a dye of ochre, the traditional colour of the Swami order. After the cloth had dried, my guru draped it around me as a renunciant's robe. "Some day you will go to the West, where silk is preferred," he said. "As a symbol, I have chosen for you this silk material instead of the customary cotton. In India, where monks embrace the ideal of poverty, a silk-clad Swami is an unusual sight. Many yogis, however, wear garments of silk, which retains certain subtle bodily currents better than cotton." "I am averse to ceremonies," Sri Yukteswar remarked. "I will make you a Swami in the bidwat, non-ceremonious manner." The bibidissa, or elaborate initiation into Swamihood, includes a fire ceremony, during which symbolical funeral rites are performed. The physical body of the disciple is represented as dead, cremated in the flame of wisdom. The newly made Swami is then given a chant, such as, "This Atma is Brahma," or "Thou art that," or "I am he." Sri Yukteswar, however, with his love of simplicity, dispensed with all formal rites and merely asked me to select a new name. "I will give you the privilege of choosing it yourself," he said, smiling. "Yogananda," I replied after a moment's thought. "The name means bliss, ananda, through divine union, yoga." "Be it so. Forsaking your family name of Mukunda Lal Ghosh, henceforth you should be called Yogananda of the Giri branch of the Swami order." I then knelt before Sri Yukteswar, and for the first time heard him pronounce my new name, my heart overflowed with gratitude. How lovingly and tirelessly had he laboured that the boy Mukunda be some day transformed into the monk Yogananda. I joyfully sang a few verses from the long Sanskrit chant of Lord Shankara. "Mind, nor intellect, nor ego, feeling, sky, nor earth, nor metals am I. I am he, I am he, blessed spirit, I am he. No birth, no death, no caste have I, father, mother have I none. I am he, I am he, blessed spirit, I am he. Beyond the flights of fancy, formless am I, permeating the limbs of all life. Bondage I do not fear, I am free, ever free. I am he, blessed spirit, I am he." Every Swami belongs to the monastic order that has been honoured in India from time immemorial. Reorganised in its present form centuries ago by Shankaracharya, it has since been headed by an unbroken line of venerable teachers, each of whom successively bears the title of Jagadguru Sri Shankaracharya. Many monks, perhaps a million, make up the Swami order. To enter it, they fulfill a requirement to receive initiation from men who themselves are Swamis. All monks of the Swami order thus trace their spiritual lineage to a common guru, Adi, the first, Shankaracharya. They take their vows of poverty, non-attachment to possessions, chastity, and obedience to the head or spiritual authority. In many ways, the Catholic Christian monastic orders resemble the more ancient order of Swamis. To his new name, a Swami adds a word that indicates his formal connection with one of the 10 subdivisions of the Swami order. These Dasanamis, or 10 agnomens, include the Giri, mountain, to which Swami Sri Yukteswargiri and hence I myself belong. Among the other branches are Sagara, Sea, Bharati, Land, Puri, Tract, Saraswati, Wisdom of Nature, Tirtha, Place of Pilgrimage, and Aranya, Forest. A Swami's monastic name, which usually ends in Ananda, Supreme Bliss, signifies his aspiration to attain emancipation through a particular path, state, or divine quality, love, wisdom, discrimination, devotion, service, yoga. His agnomen indicates harmony with nature. The ideal of selfless service to all mankind and of renunciation of personal ties and ambitions leads most Swamis to engage actively in humanitarian and educational work in India or occasionally in foreign lands. Discarding prejudices of caste, creed, class, color, sex, and race, a Swami follows the precepts of human brotherhood. His goal is absolute unity with spirit, imbuing his waking and sleeping consciousness with the thought, I am he. He roams contentedly, in the world, but not of it. Thus only may he justify his title of Swami, one who seeks to achieve union with the Swa, or Self. Sri Yukteswar was both a Swami and a Yogi. A Swami, formerly a monk by virtue of his connection with the Venerable Order, is not always a Yogi. Anyone who practices a scientific technique for divine realization is a yogi. He may be either married or unmarried, either a man of worldly responsibilities or one of formal religious ties. A Swami may conceivably follow only the path of dry reasoning, of cold renunciation, but a yogi engages himself in a definite step-by-step procedure by which the body and mind are disciplined and the soul gradually liberated. Taking nothing for granted on emotional grounds or by faith, a yogi practices a thoroughly tested series of exercises that were first mapped out by the ancient rishis. In every age of India, yoga has produced men who became truly free, true yogi Christs. Like any other science, yoga is applicable by people of every clime and time. The theory advanced by certain ignorant writers that yoga is dangerous or unsuitable for Westerners is wholly false, and has lamentably deterred many sincere students from seeking its manifold blessings. Yoga is a method for restraining the natural turbulence of thoughts, which otherwise impartially prevents all men of all lands from glimpsing their true nature of spirit. Like the healing light of the sun, yoga is beneficially equal to men of the East and to men of the West. The thoughts of most persons are restless and capricious. A manifest need exists for yoga, the science of mind control. The ancient rishi Patanjali defines yoga as neutralization of the alternating waves in consciousness. His short and masterly work, Yoga Sutras, forms one of the six systems of Hindu philosophy. In contradistinction to Western philosophies, all six Hindu systems embody not only theoretical teachings, but practical ones also. After pursuing every conceivable ontological inquiry, the Hindu systems formulate six definite disciplines aimed at the permanent removal of suffering and the attainment of timeless bliss. The later Upanishads uphold the Yoga Sutras, among the six systems, as containing the most efficacious methods for achieving direct perception of truth. Through the practical techniques of yoga, man leaves behind forever the barren realms of speculation and cognizes in experience the veritable essence. The yoga system of Patanjali is known as the Eightfold Path. The first steps are 1. Yama, moral conduct, and 2. Niyama, religious observances. Yama is fulfilled by non-injury to others, truthfulness, non-stealing, continence, and non-covetousness. The niyama prescripts are purity of body and mind, contentment in all circumstances, self-discipline, self-study, contemplation, and devotion to God and Guru. The next steps are 3. Asana, right posture, the spinal column must be held straight, and the body firm in a comfortable position for meditation. 4. Pranayama, control of prana, subtle life currents. And 5. Pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses from external objects. The last steps are forms of yoga proper. 6. Dharana, concentration, holding the mind to one thought. 7. Dhyana, meditation. And 8. Samadhi, superconscious experience. This eightfold path of yoga leads to the final goal of Kaivalya, absoluteness, in which the yogi realizes the truth beyond all intellectual apprehension. Which is greater, one may ask, a swami or a yogi? If and when oneness with God is achieved, the distinctions of the various paths disappear. The Bhagavad Gita, however, has pointed out that the methods of yoga are all-embracing. Its techniques are not meant only for certain types and temperaments, such as those few persons who incline towards the monastic life. Yoga requires no formal allegiance. Because the yogic science satisfies a universal need, it has a natural, universal appeal. A true yogi may remain dutifully in the world. There he is like butter on water, and not like the unchurned, easily diluted milk of undisciplined humanity. Fulfilling one's earthly responsibilities need not separate man from God, provided he maintains mental uninvolvement with egotistical desires and plays his part in life as a willing instrument of the divine. There are a number of great men, living today in America or European or other non-Hindu bodies, who, though they may never have heard the words yogi and swami, are yet true exemplars of those terms. Through their disinterested service to mankind, or through their mastery over passions and thoughts, or through their single-hearted love of God, or through their great powers of concentration, they are, in a sense, yogis. They have set themselves the goal of yoga, self-control. These men could rise even to greater heights if they were taught the definite science of yoga, which makes possible a more conscious direction of one's mind and life. Yoga has been superficially misunderstood by certain Western writers, but its critics have never been its practitioners. Among many thoughtful tributes to yoga may be mentioned one by Dr. C.G. Jung, the famous Swiss psychologist. When a religious method recommends itself as scientific, it can be certain of its public in the West. Yoga fulfills this expectation, Dr. Jung writes. Quite apart from the charm of the new and the fascination of the half-understood, there is good cause for yoga to have many adherents. It offers the possibility of controllable experience and thus satisfies the scientific need for facts. And besides this, by reason of its breadth and depth, its venerable age, its doctrine and method, which include every phase of life, it promises undreamt of possibilities. Every religious or philosophical practice means a psychological discipline, that is, a method of mental hygiene. The manifold, purely bodily procedures of yoga, Dr. Jung here is referring to Hatha Yoga, also mean a physiological hygiene which is superior to ordinary gymnastics and breathing exercises, inasmuch as it is not merely mechanistic and scientific, but also philosophical in its training of the parts of the body. It unites them with the whole of the spirit, as is quite clear, for instance, in the pranayama exercises, where prana is both the breath and the universal dynamics of the cosmos. Yoga practice would be ineffectual without the concepts on which yoga is based. It combines the bodily and the spiritual in an extraordinarily complete way. In the East, where these ideas and practices have developed, and where for several thousand years an unbroken tradition has created the necessary spiritual foundations, yoga is, as I can readily believe, the perfect and appropriate method of fusing body and mind together so that they form a unity which is scarcely to be questioned. This unity creates a psychological disposition which makes possible intuitions that transcend consciousness. Many uninformed persons speak of yoga as hatha yoga, or consider yoga to be magic, dark mysterious rites for attaining spectacular powers. Hatha yoga is a specialized branch of bodily postures and techniques for health and longevity. Hatha is useful and produces spectacular physical results, but this branch of yoga is little used by yogis bent on spiritual liberation. When scholars, however, speak of yoga, they mean the system expounded in Yoga Sutras, also known as Patanjali's aphorisms, Raja, royal yoga. The treatise embodies philosophic concepts of such grandeur as to have inspired commentaries by some of India's greatest thinkers, including the illuminated master Sadasivendra. Like the other five orthodox, Vedas-based philosophical systems, Yoga Sutras considers the magic of moral purity, the Ten Commandments of Yama and Niyama, to be the indispensable preliminary for sound philosophical investigation. This personal demand, not insisted on in the West, has bestowed lasting vitality on the six Indian disciplines. The cosmic order, Rita, that upholds the universe, is not different from the moral order that rules man's destiny. He who is unwilling to observe the universal moral precepts is not seriously determined to pursue truth. Section 3 of Yoga Sutras mentions various yogic miraculous powers, vibhutis and siddhis. True knowledge is always power. The path of yoga is divided into four stages, each with its vibhuti expression. Achieving a certain power, the yogi knows that he has successfully passed the tests of one of the four stages. Emergence of the characteristic powers is evidence of the scientific structure of the yoga system, wherein delusive imaginations about one's spiritual progress are banished. Proof is required. Patanjali warns the devotee that unity with spirit should be the sole goal, not the possession of vibhutis, the merely incidental flowers along the sacred path. May the eternal giver be sought, not his phenomenal gifts. God does not reveal himself to a seeker who is satisfied with any lesser attainment. The striving yogi is therefore careful not to exercise his phenomenal powers, lest they arouse false pride and distract him from entering the ultimate state of Kaivalya. When the yogi has reached his infinite goal, he exercises the vibhutis, or refrains from exercising them, just as he pleases. All his actions, miraculous or otherwise, are then performed without karmic involvement. The iron filings of karma are attracted only where a magnet of the personal ego still exists. The Western day is nearing, when the inner science of self-control will be found as necessary as the outer conquest of nature. The atomic age will see men's minds sobered and broadened by the now scientifically indisputable truth that matter is in reality a concentrate of energy. The human mind can and must liberate within itself energies greater than those within stones and metals, lest the material atomic giant, newly unleashed, turn on the world in mindless destruction. An indirect benefit of mankind's concern over atomic bombs may be an increased practical interest in the science of yoga, a bomb-proof shelter, truly. Chapter 25. Brother Ananta and Sister Nalini. Ananta cannot live. The sands of his karma for this life have run out. These inexorable words reached my inner consciousness as I sat one morning in deep meditation. Shortly after I had entered the Swami order, I paid a visit to my birthplace, Gorakhpur, as the guest of my elder brother, Ananta. A sudden illness confined him to his bed. I nursed him lovingly. The solemn inward pronouncement filled me with grief. I felt that I could not bear to remain longer in Gorakhpur, only to see my brother removed before my helpless gaze. Amidst uncomprehending criticism from my relatives, I left India on the first available boat. It cruised along Burma and the China Sea to Japan. I disembarked at Kobe, where I spent only a few days. My heart was too heavy for sightseeing. On the return trip to India, the boat touched at Shanghai. There, Dr. Misra, the ship's physician, guided me to several curio shops, where I selected various presents for Sri Yukteswar and my family and friends. For Ananta, I purchased a large carved bamboo piece. No sooner had the Chinese salesman handed me the bamboo souvenir than I dropped it on the floor, crying out, "I have bought this for my dear dead brother." A clear realization had swept over me that his soul was just being freed in the infinite. The souvenir was sharply and symbolically cracked by its fall. Amidst sobs, I wrote on the bamboo surface, "For my beloved Ananta, now gone." My companion, the doctor, had been observing me with a sardonic smile. "Save your tears," he remarked. "Why shed them until you're sure he's dead?" When our boat reached Calcutta, Dr. Misra again accompanied me. My youngest brother, Bishnu, was waiting to greet me at the dock. "I know Ananta has departed this life," I said to Bishnu before he had time to speak. "Please tell me, and the doctor here, when Ananta died." Bishnu named the date, which was the very day that I had bought the souvenirs in Shanghai. "Look here," Dr. Misra ejaculated. "Don't let any word of this get around. The professors will be adding a year's study of mental telepathy to the medical course, which is already long enough." Father embraced me warmly as I entered our home. "You have come," he said tenderly. Two large tears dropped from his eyes. Ordinarily undemonstrative, he had never before shown me these external signs of affection. Outwardly the grave father, inwardly he possessed the melting heart of a mother. In all family affairs he played this dual parental role. Soon after Ananta's passing, my younger sister, Nalini, was brought back from death's door by a divine healing. Before relating the story, I will refer to a few phases of our earlier life. The childhood relationship between Nalini and me had not been of the happiest nature. I was very thin, she was thinner still. Through an unconscious motive that psychologists will have no difficulty in identifying, I would often tease my sister about her appearance. Her retorts would be equally imbued with the callous frankness of extreme youth. Sometimes mother would intervene, temporarily ending the childish quarrels by a gentle box on my ear, as the elder ear. After her school years were over, Nalini was betrothed to Dr. Panchanon Bose, a likable young physician of Calcutta. Elaborate marriage rites were celebrated in due time. On the wedding night, I joined the large, jovial group of relatives in the living room of our Calcutta home. The bridegroom was leaning on an immense gold-brocaded pillow, with Nalini at his side. A gorgeous purple silk sari could not, alas, wholly hide her angularity. I sheltered myself behind the pillow of my new brother-in-law and grinned at him, in friendly fashion. He had never seen Nalini until the day of the nuptial ceremony, when he finally learned what he was getting in the matrimonial lottery. Feeling my sympathy, Dr. Bose pointed unobtrusively to Nalini and whispered in my ear, "Say, what's this?" "Why, doctor," I replied, "it is a skeleton, for your observation." As the years went on, Dr. Bose endeared himself to our family, who called on him whenever illness arose. He and I became fast friends, often joking together, usually with Nalini as our target. "It is a medical curiosity," my brother-in-law remarked to me one day. "I have tried everything on your lean sister. Cod liver oil, butter, malt, honey, fish, meat, eggs, tonics. Still she fails to bulge even 1/100th of an inch." A few days later, I visited the Bose home. My errand there took only a few minutes. I was leaving unnoticed, I thought, by Nalini. As I reached the front door, I heard her voice, cordial but commanding. "Brother, come here. You are not going to give me the slip this time. I want to talk with you." I mounted the stairs to her room. To my surprise, she was in tears. "Dear brother," she said, "let us bury the old hatchet. I see that your feet are now firmly set on the spiritual path. I want to become like you in every way." She added hopefully, "You are now robust in appearance. Will you help me? My husband does not come near me, and I love him so dearly. But my chief desire is to progress in God realization, even if I must remain thin and unattractive." My heart was deeply touched at her plea. Our new friendship steadily progressed. One day she asked to become my disciple. "Train me in any way you like. I put my trust in God instead of tonics." She gathered together an armful of medicines and poured them down a drain outside her window. As a test of her faith, I asked her to omit from her diet all fish, meat, and eggs. After several months, during which Nalini had strictly followed the various rules I had outlined, and had adhered to her vegetarian diet in spite of numerous difficulties, I paid her a visit. "Sis, you have been conscientiously observing the spiritual injunctions. Your reward is near." I smiled mischievously. "How plump do you want to be? As fat as our aunt, who hasn't seen her feet in years?" "No, but I long to be as stout as you are." I replied solemnly, "By the grace of God, as I have spoken truth always, I speak truly now. Through the divine blessings, your body shall verily change from today. In 1 month, it shall have the same weight as mine." These words from my heart found fulfillment. In 30 days, Nalini's weight equaled mine. The new roundness gave her beauty. Her husband fell deeply in love. Their marriage, begun so inauspiciously, turned out to be ideally happy. On my return from Japan, I learned that during my absence, Nalini had been stricken with typhoid fever. I rushed to her home and was aghast to find it extremely emaciated. She was in a coma. My brother-in-law told me, before her mind became confused by illness, she often said, "If Brother Mukunda were here, I would not be faring thus." He added tearfully, "The other doctors and I see no ray of hope. After her long bout with typhoid, blood dysentery has now set in." I tried to move heaven and earth with my prayers. Engaging an Anglo-Indian nurse, who gave me full cooperation, I applied on my sister various yoga methods of healing. The blood dysentery vanished. But Dr. Bose shook his head mournfully. "She simply has no more blood left to shed." "She will recover," I replied stoutly. "In 7 days, her fever will be gone." A week later, I was thrilled to see Nalini open her eyes and gaze at me with loving recognition. From that day, her recovery was swift. Although she regained her usual weight, she bore one sad scar of her nearly fatal illness. Her legs were paralyzed. Indian and English specialists pronounced her a hopeless cripple. The incessant war for her life that I had waged by prayer had exhausted me. I went to Serampore to ask Sri Yukteswar's help. His eyes expressed deep sympathy as I told him of Nalini's plight. "Your sister's legs will be normal at the end of 1 month. He added, "Let her wear, next to her skin, a band with an unperforated 2-carat pearl, held on by a clasp." I prostrated myself at his feet with joyful relief. "Sir, you are a master. Your word that she will recover is enough, but if you insist, I will immediately get her a pearl." My guru nodded. "Yes, do that." He went on to describe correctly the physical and mental characteristics of Nalini, whom he had never seen. "Sir," I inquired, "is this an astrological analysis? You do not know her birthday or hour." Sri Yukteswar smiled. "There is a deeper astrology, not dependent on the testimony of calendars and clocks. Each man is a part of the Creator, or cosmic man. He has a heavenly body as well as one of earth. The human eye sees the physical form, but the inner eye penetrates more profoundly, even to the universal pattern of which each man is an integral and individual part." I returned to Calcutta and purchased a pearl for Nalini. A month later, her paralyzed legs were completely healed. Sister asked me to convey her heartfelt gratitude to my guru. He listened to the message in silence, but as I was taking my leave, he made a pregnant comment. "Your sister has been told by many doctors that she can never bear children. Assure her that within a few years she will give birth to 2 daughters. Some years later, to Nalini's joy, she bore a girl, and in a few more years, another daughter. Chapter 26. The Science of Kriya Yoga. The science of Kriya Yoga, mentioned so often in these pages, became widely known in modern India through the instrumentality of Lahiri Mahashay, my guru's guru. The Sanskrit root of Kriya is Kri, to do, to act and react. The same root is found in the word karma, the natural principle of cause and effect. Kriya Yoga is thus union, yoga, with the infinite through a certain action or rite, Kriya. A yogi who faithfully practices the technique is gradually freed from karma or the lawful chain of cause-effect equilibriums. Because of certain ancient yogic injunctions, I may not give a full explanation of Kriya Yoga in a book intended for the general public. The actual technique should be learned from an authorized Kriyaban, Kriya Yogi, of Self-Realization Fellowship, Yogoda Satsanga Society of India. Here a broad reference must suffice. Kriya Yoga is a simple, psychophysiological method by which human blood is decarbonated and recharged with oxygen. The atoms of this extra oxygen are transmuted into life current to rejuvenate the brain and spinal centers. By stopping the accumulation of venous blood, the yogi is able to lessen or prevent the decay of tissues. The advanced yogi transmutes his cells into energy. Elijah, Jesus, Kabir, and other prophets were past masters in the use of Kriya, or a similar technique, by which they caused their bodies to materialize and dematerialize at will. Kriya is an ancient science. Lahiri Mahashay received it from his great guru, Babaji, who rediscovered and clarified the technique after it had been lost in the Dark Ages. Babaji renamed it simply Kriya Yoga. "The Kriya Yoga that I am giving to the world through you in this 19th century," Babaji told Lahiri Mahashay, "is a revival of the same science that Krishna gave millenniums ago to Arjuna, and that was later known to Patanjali and Christ, and to St. John, St. Paul, and other disciples. Kriya Yoga is twice referred to by Lord Krishna, India's greatest prophet, in the Bhagavad Gita. One stanza reads, 'Offering the inhaling breath into the exhaling breath, and offering the exhaling breath into the inhaling breath, the yogi neutralizes both breaths. Thus he releases prana from the heart and brings life force under his control.' The interpretation is the yogi arrests decay in the body by securing an additional supply of prana, life force, through quieting the action of the lungs and heart. He also arrests mutations of growth in the body by control of apana, eliminating current, thus neutralizing decay and growth. The yogi learns life force control. Another Gita stanza states that meditation expert Muni becomes eternally free who, seeking the supreme goal, is able to withdraw from external phenomena by fixing his gaze within the mid-spot of the eyebrows and by neutralizing the even currents of prana and apana that flow within the nostrils and lungs, and to control his sensory mind and intellect, and to banish desire, fear, and anger. Krishna also relates that it was he, in a former incarnation, who communicated the indestructible yoga to an ancient illuminato, Vivasvat, who gave it to Manu, the great legislator. He, in turn, instructed Ishvaku, the founder of India's solar warrior dynasty. Passing thus from one to another, the royal yoga was guarded by the rishis until the coming of the materialistic ages. Then, because of priestly secrecy and man's indifference, the sacred law gradually became inaccessible. Kriya Yoga is mentioned twice by the ancient sage Patanjali, foremost exponent of yoga, who wrote, "Kriya Yoga consists of body discipline, mental control, and meditating on Om." Patanjali speaks of God as the actual cosmic sound of Om that is heard in meditation. Om is the creative word, the whir of the vibratory motor, the witness of divine presence. "These things," saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Revelations 3:14. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him," the Word, or Om, "and without him was not anything made that was made." John 1:1-3. Om of the Vedas became the sacred word Hom of the Tibetans, Amin of the Muslims, and Amen of the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Jews, and Christians. Its meaning in Hebrew is sure, faithful. Even the beginner in yoga may soon hear the wondrous sound of Om. Through this blissful spiritual encouragement, he becomes convinced that he is in communion with supernal realms. Patanjali refers a second time to the Kriya technique or life force control thus: "Liberation can be attained by that pranayama which is accomplished by disjoining the course of inspiration and expiration." St. Paul knew Kriya Yoga, or a similar technique, by which he could switch life currents to and from the senses. He was therefore able to say, "I protest by our rejoicing which I have in Christ, I die daily." By a method of centering inwardly all bodily life force, which ordinarily is directed only outwardly, to the sensory world, thus lending it a seeming validity, St. Paul experienced daily a true yoga union with the rejoicing, bliss of the Christ consciousness. In that felicitous state, he was conscious of being dead to, or freed from, sensory delusions, the world of Maya. In the initial states of God communion, Sabikalpa Samadhi, the devotee's consciousness merges in the cosmic spirit. His life force is withdrawn from the body, which appears dead, or motionless and rigid. The yogi is fully aware of his bodily condition of suspended animation. As he progresses to higher spiritual states, Nirvikalpa Samadhi, however, he communes with God without bodily fixation, and in his ordinary waking consciousness, even in the midst of exacting worldly duties. Kriya Yoga is an instrument through which human evolution can be quickened, Sri Yukteswar explained to his students. The ancient yogis discovered that the secret of cosmic consciousness is intimately linked with breath mastery. This is India's unique and deathless contribution to the world's treasury of knowledge. The life force, which is ordinarily absorbed in maintaining heart action, must be freed for higher activities by a method of calming and stilling the ceaseless demands of the breath. The Kriya Yogi mentally directs his life energy to revolve, upward and downward, around the six spinal centers, medullary, cervical, dorsal, lumbar, sacral, and coccygeal plexuses, which correspond to the 12 astral signs of the zodiac, the symbolic cosmic man. 1/2 minute of revolution of energy around the sensitive spinal cord of man effects subtle progress in his evolution. That 1/2 minute of Kriya equals 1 year of natural spiritual unfoldment. The astral system of a human being, with 6, 12 by polarity, inner constellations revolving around the sun of the omniscient spiritual eye, is interrelated with the physical sun and the 12 zodiacal signs. All men are thus affected by an inner and an outer universe. The ancient rishis discovered that man's earthly and heavenly environment, in a series of 12-year cycles, push him forward on his natural path. The scriptures aver that man requires 1,000,000 years of normal, diseaseless evolution to perfect his human brain and attain cosmic consciousness. 1,000 kriyas, practiced in 8.5 hours, gives the yogi, in 1 day, the equivalent of 1,000 years of natural evolution. 365,000 years of evolution in 1 year. In 3 years, a Kriya Yogi can thus accomplish by intelligent self-effort the same result that nature brings to pass in 1,000,000 years. The Kriya shortcut, of course, can be taken only by deeply developed yogis. With the guidance of a guru, such yogis have carefully prepared their body and brain to withstand the power generated by intensive practice. The Kriya beginner employs his yogic technique only 14 to 24 times, twice daily. A number of yogis achieve emancipation in 6 or 12 or 24 or 48 years. A yogi who dies before achieving full realization carries with him the good karma of his past Kriya effort. In his new life, he is naturally propelled towards his infinite goal. The body of the average man is like a 50-watt lamp, which cannot accommodate the 1,000,000,000 watts of power roused by an excessive practice of Kriya. Through gradual and regular increase of the simple and foolproof methods of Kriya, man's body becomes astrally transformed day by day, and is finally fitted to express the infinite potentials of cosmic energy, which constitutes the first materially active expression of spirit. Kriya Yoga has nothing in common with the unscientific breathing exercises taught by a number of misguided zealots. Attempts to hold breath forcibly in the lungs are unnatural and decidedly unpleasant. Kriya practice, on the other hand, is accompanied from the very beginning by feelings of peace and by soothing sensations of regenerative effect in the spine. The ancient yogic technique converts the breath into mind stuff. By spiritual advancement, one is able to cognize the breath as a mental concept, an act of mind, a dream breath. Many illustrations could be given of the mathematical relationship between man's respiratory rate and the variations in his states of consciousness. A person whose attention is wholly engrossed, as in following some closely knit intellectual argument, or in attempting some delicate or difficult physical feat, automatically breathes very slowly. Fixity of attention depends on slow breathing. Quick or uneven breaths are an inevitable accompaniment of harmful emotional states. Fear, lust, anger. The restless monkey breathes at the rate of 32 times a minute, in contrast to man's average of 18 times. The elephant, tortoise, snake and other creatures noted for their longevity have a respiratory rate that is less than man's. The giant tortoise, for instance, which may attain the age of 300 years, breathes only 4 times a minute. The rejuvenating effects of sleep are due to man's temporary unawareness of body and breathing. The sleeping man becomes a yogi. Each night he unconsciously performs the yogic rite of releasing himself from bodily identification and of merging the life force with healing currents in the main brain region and in the 6 subdynamos of his spinal centers. Unknowingly, the sleeper is thus recharged by the cosmic energy that sustains all life. The voluntary yogi performs a simple, natural process consciously, not unconsciously, like the slow-paced sleeper. The Kriya yogi uses his technique to saturate and feed all his physical cells with undecayable light, and thus to keep them in a spiritually magnetized condition. He scientifically makes breathing unnecessary, and does not enter, during his hours of practice, the negative states of sleep, unconsciousness, or death. In men under Maya or natural law, the flow of life energy is toward the outer world. The currents are wasted and abused in the senses. The practice of Kriya reverses the flow. Life force is mentally guided to the inner cosmos and becomes reunited with subtle spinal energies. By such reinforcement of life force, the yogi's body and brain cells are renewed by a spiritual elixir. Through proper food, sunlight, and harmonious thoughts, men who are led only by nature and her divine plan will achieve self-realization in a million years. 12 years of normal, healthful living are required to effect even slight refinements in brain structure. 1 million solar returns are exacted to purify the cerebral tenement sufficiently for manifestation of cosmic consciousness. A Kriya yogi, however, by use of a spiritual science, removes himself from the necessity for a long period of careful observance of natural laws. Untying the cord of breath that binds the soul to the body, Kriya serves to prolong life and to enlarge the consciousness to infinity. The yoga technique overcomes the tug-of-war between the mind and the matter-entangled senses, and frees the devotee to re-inherit his eternal kingdom. He knows then that his real being is bound neither by physical encasement nor by breath. Symbol of mortal man's enslavement to air, to nature's elemental compulsions. Master of his body and mind, the Kriya yogi ultimately achieves victory over the last enemy, death. So shalt thou feed on death that feeds on men, and death, once dead, there's no more dying then. Introspection, or sitting in the silence, is an unscientific way of trying to force apart the mind and senses, tied together by the life force. The contemplative mind, attempting its return to divinity, is constantly dragged back toward the senses by the life currents. Kriya, controlling the mind directly through the life force, is the easiest, most effective, and most scientific avenue of approach to the infinite. In contrast to the slow, uncertain bullock cart theological path to God, Kriya Yoga may justly be called the airplane route. The yogic science is based on an empirical consideration of all forms of concentration and meditation techniques. Yoga enables the devotee to switch off or on at will life current to the 5 sense telephones of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. Attaining this power of sense disconnection, the yogi finds it simple to unite his mind at will with divine realms or with the world of matter. No longer is he unwillingly brought back by the life force to the mundane sphere of rowdy sensations and restless thoughts. The life of an advanced Kriya Yogi is influenced not by effects of past actions, but solely by directions from the soul. The devotee thus avoids the slow evolutionary monitors of egotistic actions, good and bad, of common life, cumbrous and snail-like to the eagle hearts. The superior method of soul-living frees the yogi. Emerging from his ego prison, he tastes the deep air of omnipresence. The thraldom of natural living is, in contrast, set in a pace humiliating. Conforming his life merely to the evolutionary order, a man can command no concessionary haste from nature. Though he live without error against the laws that govern his body and mind, he still requires a million years of masquerading incarnations to attain final emancipation. The telescopic methods of a yogi, disengaging himself from physical and mental identifications in favor of soul individuality, are therefore commended to those who eye with revolt 1,000,000 years. This numerical periphery is enlarged for the ordinary man, who lives in harmony not even with nature, let alone his soul. Pursuing instead unnatural complexities and offending in his thoughts and body the sweet sanities of nature, for him, 2 times a million years can scarce suffice for liberation. Gross man seldom or never realizes that his body is a kingdom, governed by emperor soul on the throne of the cranium, with subsidiary regents in the 6 spinal centers, or spheres of consciousness. This theocracy extends over a throng of obedient subjects. 27,000 billion cells, endowed with sure, if seemingly automatic intelligence, by which they perform all duties of bodily growths, transformations, and dissolutions, and 50 million substratal thoughts, emotions, and variations of alternating phases in man's consciousness in an average life of 60 years. Any apparent insurrection in the human body or mind against emperor soul, manifesting as disease or irrationality, is due to no disloyalty among the humble subjects, but stems from past or present misuse by man of his individuality or free will, given to him simultaneously with a soul, and revocable never. Identifying himself with a shallow ego, man takes for granted that it is he who thinks, wills, feels, digests meals, and keeps himself alive, never admitting through reflection, only a little would suffice, that in his ordinary life he is naught but a puppet of past actions, karma, and of nature or environment. Each man's intellectual reactions, feelings, moods, and habits are merely effects of past causes, whether of this or a prior life. Lofty above such influences, however, is his regal soul. Spurning the transitory truths and freedoms, the Kriya Yogi passes beyond all disillusionment into his unfettered being. The world's scriptures declare man to be not a corruptible body, but a living soul. In Kriya Yoga, he finds a method to prove the scriptural affirmation. Outward ritual cannot destroy ignorance, because they are not mutually contradictory, wrote Shankara in his famous Century of Verses. Realized knowledge alone destroys ignorance. Knowledge cannot spring up by any other means than inquiry. Who am I? How was this universe born? Who is its maker? What is its material cause? This is the kind of inquiry referred to. The intellect has no answer for these questions, hence the rishis evolved yoga as the technique of spiritual inquiry. The true yogi, withholding his thoughts, will, and feelings from false identification with bodily desires, uniting his mind with superconscious forces in the spinal shrines, thus lives in the world as God hath planned. He is impelled neither by impulses from the past, nor by fresh motivations of human witlessness. Receiving